The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 8.
Chapter 58. I called all elements, telling them to maintain eyes on their respective targets, wondering if we weren't missing other hunters searching elsewhere in the park, something that could prove catastrophic. In military operations, one of the worst things you could do was to solely plan against the enemy you'd confirmed, only to see your carefully detailed operation eviscerated by some element you didn't know existed and hadn't anticipated. I needed to get Carly out clean, without bumping into either the ones we knew or the ones we didn't. Thread the needle, as it were, escaping and letting them search an empty park. I could handle the problem right now, but if there were more stalkers than the ones we saw, all of them would race to the first sign of trouble, swarming on us like flies to roadkill. Thank God for Veep, I thought. If he hadn't been new, I would have winged this meeting and missed the trap. Carly was the linchpin, the key. They knew her, but they didn't know my team, and it made me sick that I'd put her in danger. She'd come because she was trying to help Guy, and now she was being hunted because of it. There was no way I'd let any harm come to her. The thought broke open a nascent truth, like the final letters in a crossword puzzle spilling out a hidden connection. The Arab was here, and he was hunting Carly in order to find Guy. But the only way the Arab would know Carly existed was because of her connection to Nikos, which meant he would have to know that she'd set up a meeting between Guy and Nikos. Guy was right. There was a conspiracy threaded through all of this, and it wasn't just because of some mafioso done wrong scenario. The Arabs were doing something bad enough to hunt a CIA agent to prevent Guy from interfering. Jennifer and Carly were almost out of sight, winding through the paths at a rapid clip. Carly glanced at me once, questioning what she'd become involved in. But Jennifer never looked back. Scanning every bush, she walked with her hand on her purse as if to keep it protected from pickpockets. But I knew what she was protecting. Her ability to withdraw her suppressed Glock 27 and blast the shit out of anyone in her way. I remained on my bench waiting on the hunters to cross my path in their search for Carly, waiting on whatever endgame they had planned. Then I realized I was playing their game. Why did I give a crap what they had planned? The damn Arab from Guy's target package was in the park, and he should be worried about what I had planned. The Oversight Council hadn't given us Alpha authority yet, but this situation wasn't of my creation. One of the men Guy was stalking was in the park, had coordinated with a known organized crime figure, and was targeting a CIA agent. And it isn't my fault. I couldn't be blamed for capturing a guy out to kill Carly. I clicked on the radio saying, "Coco, Coco, hold up." She came back saying, "What? Threat to my front? No, just stand by. All elements, give me a status." Knuckles said, "Still got the Arab in sight. He seems to be controlling things. He's not searching, and the guy with him is deferring to his commands." Brett said, "I'm on my two. They're searching the south end of the park. They're in cell contact with someone, most likely the Arab." I said, "Roger all, Veep." "I got my two. They're closing in on the gazebo. You should have them in sight shortly." I stood seeing a bench hidden underneath some low-hanging shrubs. I moved that way, saying, "Any other indications, any unknowns not previously tagged?" I heard nothing. I said, "Okay, everyone, listen up. I want Coco to bring Spook back down to my location. Go past Veep's targets. Let them see her. Then continue south where the footpaths get narrow and turn into spaghetti, the thick area of the park." Nobody responded for a moment, and I could imagine what was going through their heads. I waited. Knuckles came on. "Pike, what's going through the granite in your skull?" I said, "Remember that op in Sri Lanka? The Rambo operation? Yeah, that's what I've got in mind." "I know this doesn't need to be said, but we've got no sanction for that." I said, "I can't help it if these assholes chose to interdict our sanctioned mission. You think we can do it? Here?" Knuckles said nothing for a moment. I was about to ask again, wanting his opinion, truthfully, wanting his approval. When he came back on, "Yeah, I think so. With a little luck, we can do it. The guys I'm with are the key. They're controlling this thing. They need to go last. I said, understood. That's exactly what I was thinking. The Arab is the end state. We're taking him with us. Jennifer broke her radio silence. Pike, we don't have even Alpha yet. You're talking about an Omega mission on foreign soil, using an uncleared person as bait. Meaning Carly would see what we were doing. I started to answer when the two pipe swingers from Veep came into the clearing. I said, break, break, Veep. Your target set has one with a beard, one with glasses, wearing a cheesy tracksuit. Nick said, that's my target set. What are we doing? Stand by, break, break. Coco, hold what you got. I don't want them to see Carly too early. Brett, are you clear of the gazebo? No chance they can intervene? No, we're way south. But I'm echoing Veep, what are we doing? Shit, I thought. I realized that only two people on the net remembered Sri Lanka, Knuckles and me. It would be much easier to give orders based on a historical mission we all had participated in. But nobody else had been in the task force at the time. I said, okay, everyone, listen close. This is like 10 little Indians. We're going to take each team one at a time. Coco is the rabbit, and she'll lead them one by one into a kill zone in the south of the park, where it's overgrown. Veep, you're up first. Pick an ambush spot and mark it on your phone. Then coordinate with Coco. She'll drag them in, and you take them out. Be sure you can stash the bodies. I heard nothing. I said, Veep, you copy. He came on a sharp tone in his transmission. Yes, I copy. But you want me to kill someone here in Greece? I was shocked at the comment, then realized he wasn't yet an official team member. He'd had no probation missions, no easy tasks to get him seasoned, and no operations with a mentor to make sure he understood our ethos. He was being thrown into operations without the trust of our organization built through experience, and was now questioning what we stood for. At this point, he was probably wondering if we hadn't killed JFK. I said, no, damn it, no lethal actions. Haven't you seen First Blood? I heard nothing for a second, then, seriously, that old movie? Yes, Jesus, that old movie. Remember when he hunted all the guys in the forest, taking them out one by one? That's what we're doing. Can you execute? Brett had picked up the game plan immediately, and because he's a smartass, came on in an imitation of Sly Sylvester's voice.
I could have killed them. I could have killed them all. Let it go, or you'll get a war you won't believe.
I said, yep, that's exactly right. 10 little Indians, taking them out one by one, but no killing. Veep, can you execute? Brett cut me off. Break, break, Pike. Pike, this is Blood. My target just entered a perfect kill zone. He's stumbling around in the woods searching. I can execute without the rabbit. You want me to do so? Do I have authority? Perfect, I thought. Oh yeah, get rid of them. Veep, Veep, you ready? I was putting a lot of pressure on our new member, but it couldn't be helped. I needed to remain out of contact because I was going to take down the Arab with Knuckles, which was critical, the whole purpose of the operation. I knew if I bagged him, I could all but guarantee bringing in Guy, solving the problem. I couldn't afford to expose myself beforehand. Nick came back, a little fear leaking through the radio. Yeah, I think so. I have a sight. I think I can do it, but Pike, there are two of them. I said, I understand. You've got Coco leading them in. She'll take one. You take the other. Can you do it? Yes, I can do it. He didn't sound that confident. Mark your position on your phone. Coco, you copy? She sounded much better than Nick. Instead of fear, I got a little aggravation. I knew she was doing it precisely to give Nick a boost of confidence, something he was sorely needing. Yeah, I copy. You are definitely buying the beer tonight. Break, break, Veep. I've got your mark. I'm inbound. I'll pass. You hit. I'll key off of you. Don't worry. This is easier than the House of Pain. He took the words in and came back a little stronger. Roger all. I hit. You assist. Easy day. I smiled, then heard Knuckles say, Pike, the Arab gets the call of a lock-on, and they're going to move. What do you want me to do? Follow or interdict? There's no good place here. Nothing hidden like in the South. The plan in motion, I stood saying, I'm coming to you. Just keep eyes on until I'm there. They start moving, you track. And if they break out, start running? He was asking all the right questions, covering the contingencies. Unfortunately, I didn't have an answer for him. Well, I did, but it wasn't something the Oversight Council would approve of. I said, Take them down. For Guy. That fucking Arab is going into a bag.
Chapter 59. Nick Seacrest felt the sweat build on his neck, the cold weather belying why it was forming. He was scared. No two ways about it. He'd moved to the south of the park, and just as Pike had said, the footpaths went from wide, 20 feet across affairs, to small single tracks, threading throughout the trees and shrubs. If he weren't careful, he'd become lost in the maze. He'd found a park bench tucked underneath a row of bushes and flanked by two ancient trees. The foliage was spilling out more than it should, unkempt and threading through the slats of the bench. Looking like a man who used to be able to afford a salon haircut but now just lived with cutting it himself. Another casualty of the Greek economy, but something that worked in his favor. He'd glanced behind the bench, but couldn't penetrate more than 4 feet into the undergrowth. Perfect for whatever he was supposed to do. He sat on the bench, waiting, analyzing the coming fight, trying to rehearse in his mind how he would attack. He scrambled to remember the hundreds of incapacitation moves he'd learned on the mat in the gym, all of them running through his mind in an endless loop as he considered, then discarded, then considered again. He'd had plenty of training in hand-to-hand combat, and could defend himself in just about any situation. In fact, had defended himself. But this was different. In the past, it had been in the heat of combat, with his life on the line and the fight forced on him, screaming and clawing while a battle raged around him. Here, he was supposed to clinically render a man unconscious without raising an alarm to anyone else wandering through the park. By himself. This is insane. His earpiece clicked, startling him. Pike, Pike, this is Blood. My target's down and hidden. Roger that. Good work. I need you to return to the hotel and get our car. Stage on the southwestern exit on the east side. The one away from the presidential palace and the guard force. Could take some time. Can you maintain control until I get back? Yeah, I think so. There's another gazebo down there where we can hold up. Between Knuckles and me, we should be good. We'll keep the Arab company. Just don't take too long. Roger all. Nick then heard his own call sign. Beep. Beep. You still good? He mustered his radio voice, the one he used when talking to aircraft. The one that always sounded calm and collected, no matter the bullets flying around, or the begging of teammates for steel on target. This is Veep, Roger. I got Coco in sight. Your targets are going to get visual in about 10 seconds. You have control. Nick took a deep breath and said a final, Roger. The pressure was incredible. It was unlike anything he'd experienced in the past. Nick was a combat controller, and he was damn good at his job. He'd been on the tip of the spear for close to 10 years, and had seen combat in both Iraq and Afghanistan, where he'd had the misfortune of being blown up by an IED. He'd fought to stay in special operations after that, but his national pedigree of being the vice president's son had intervened. Everyone was too worried about what the headlines would be if he was killed, too worried about the press. He'd been forced to reclass into another, safer military occupational specialty. He'd hated it. Then, out of the blue, he had met Pike Logan and had back-ended an invitation to the task force. A unit that didn't even exist. And he'd been allowed to train. Now he was wondering what he had been thinking. One minute they were seriously discussing killing an American task force member. The next he was in a park preparing to take down a man he wasn't even sure was bad. And the speed of operations was something else again. He'd started the morning doing nothing but counter-surveillance, but now was going to end it either as a hero or a goat. It was a different world, and it brought fear, but not about the fact that he was preparing to go hand to hand with two armed men. No, it wasn't the danger. It was a massive fear of screwing up, of letting down Pike and the rest of the team, of proving once and for all that he wasn't worthy of membership in the most exclusive club on Earth. Jennifer came on, saying, "Veep, I've got your marker. We're 1 minute out. We're dragging the two anchors behind us. You take tracksuit, I'll get the other one." Controlling his breathing, clenching and unclenching his fist, Nick said, "Roger, I got tracksuit." He decided he'd attack with a come-along joint lock to bring the man to his knees, then subdue him with a rear naked choke. Simple basic moves that he knew well. His adrenaline was so great that he was afraid of losing the fine motor skills required for anything more complex. Those two moves were muscle memory, easy to execute. He mentally went through the motions in his head, visualizing exactly how it would go down. He wondered if Jennifer was doing the same thing. Then the fact that there were two men coalesced. She's got the second guy. What if she can't take him down? For the first time, he had doubts about something besides himself. Can she do it? He remembered her words about the House of Pain, something he'd barely managed to survive. It was a culmination event at Task Force Assessment and Selection, whereby the candidate had to initially fight one, then two, finishing with taking on three task force operators, all acting as role players in a hand-to-hand slugfest, fighting through each level until he either succeeded or was knocked out. How did she know about that? Surely she hasn't done the House of Pain, has she? Chapter 60. Nick's earpiece came alive. Pike, this is Knuckles. My target set is moving south, deeper into the park. They aren't following behind Carly. What's your read? I think they're going to try to cut her off. Got a team in front and a team behind. Inside the thick area? Yep. Perfect. I'm moving you away. Nick heard the calls and was amazed at the smoothness. Almost as if they were deciding on a movie to see instead of conducting three separate hostile takedowns in a foreign country. It was a skill he yearned for, a unit he desperately wanted to prove capable of joining. And he'd know in the next few minutes. Jennifer came on. 30 seconds. Get ready. Anchor is about 20 feet behind me. I'll pass you, then pause to look at something. They should stop right in front of you, waiting on me to move. Roger all. I'm set. Tracksuit is on your side. Take him down quickly. Once I commit, I'll be occupied. I can't deal with both. You'll be occupied. It dawned on him that she was worried about his capabilities. Got it. He caught a flash of movement on the trail and saw Jennifer and Carly walking abreast, brushing the bushes on either side, walking as if they had more concern of the weather than what was about to occur. They passed him and Jennifer glanced his way. She winked. He couldn't believe it. His eyes tracked behind her and saw the two men. For the first time, he sized them up for a fight. Tracksuit was a slender man of about 5'6", while his friend was closer to 6 feet, with a large beer gut. Neither one was that imposing. On the plus side, they were the same ones he'd spotted before, giving him some comfort. There was no way they would be following if they bore no ill will. They drew abreast of his bench and stopped suddenly. He looked down the trail and saw Carly pointing into the shrubs. He wondered what she was looking at, then realized it was the execute order. Go time. Tracksuit was directly in front of him. Right foot back, left foot forward, half facing him. Joint lock, right wrist, right elbow. He sprang up and leaned forward, slapping one hand on Tracksuit's wrist and the other on the man's elbow. He slid his thumb over the joint of the man's middle finger, then drew out, holding the elbow. Nick quickly rotated, expecting the man to drop to his knees from the pain. He did not. Instead, he shouted and turned with the move, spinning in the same direction as Nick and ripping his hand from Nick's grasp, then clamping his other hand on the one Nick had at his elbow, clawing to pry it free. Nick was stunned, his plan of attack in disarray, like reliving a bad car wreck and trying to ascertain what had gone wrong. Nick couldn't comprehend how the man had escaped. Then his brain exploded with the answer. You rotated the wrong way. You had no lock. You had no control. He'd screwed up in the most amateur way possible. Instead of bringing tracksuit to his knees, all he'd done was telegraph his intentions. Desperately trying to regain the momentum, fighting for control of the arm he still held, he threw a weak jab to tracksuit's face, seeing something fly through the air in his peripheral vision. Jennifer landed on the second man's back like a demented baboon. In the span of a millisecond, she rotated her legs over the man's shoulders, riding his upper back like a teenager in a failed swimming pool chicken fight. He flailed his arms ineffectually, trying to dislodge her, and she locked her legs under his chin, using her shin bones to cut into his carotid arteries. She reached over his shoulder and grabbed her foot, pulling it up and burying his neck into the blade of her shin. Before Nick even registered that Jennifer was in the fight, tracksuit swung a roundhouse that connected with his nose, causing an explosion of stars. He stumbled back, raising his fists to protect himself. The man came in strong, throwing jabs and kicks, most connecting in one way or another. On the defensive, Nick blocked what he could, knowing he was losing the initiative and trying to formulate a new plan of attack. He was failing. Behind tracksuit, Nick saw Carly kick Jennifer's target behind the knees, and he collapsed like a felled tree, Jennifer still locking out the blood to his brain in an iron grip. Tracksuit reached behind his back, and Nick knew the threat that was coming. He forgot all about his plan, resorting to pure size and fury, and an adrenaline born of fear. He charged forward, ducking low, wrapping up Tracksuit's arms and driving him back like a blocking dummy on a football field. The man shouted, and they hit Nick's bench at full speed, Nick driving Tracksuit over it backward. They landed hard in the shrubs, Nick's weight knocking the air out of the man below him. Not giving any respite, Nick slapped the weapon out of the man's hand, then jackhammered Tracksuit's face over and over. Like an MMA fighter waiting on the referee to end the match, the other fighter clearly done. Jennifer did so, jerking Nick's arm before he could land another blow. He looked up, nose bloody, breathing heavily. She said, "You won. Help me with my guy." He looked down, and Tracksuit's face was a gory mess. He was out cold. Nick wiped the red snot from his own nose, and Jennifer offered her hand. He rose a little unsteadily, then helped her drag her target into the brush. Embarrassment seeping through, he waited on her to make the call, knowing it would be trouble for him. She keyed her radio and said, "Pike, Coco, both targets down." She winked at him, then said, "No issues." Nick felt the relief flow. It was over, and he hadn't screwed up. Jennifer said, "Let's clear out of here." Face flushed with adrenaline, Carly nodded. "Good call." Jennifer said, "Thanks for the help on that takedown." Carly smiled and said, "I thought I was a badass, but man, that was some Jason Bourne shit." Nick shrugged and said, "Thanks." Carly raised an eyebrow at his words. "Seriously? You thought I was talking about you? I've seen better fighting from a third grade schoolyard." Nick felt the flush climb up his cheeks, and Jennifer laughed. "Don't worry, Veep. I've been there. You've got some pressure as a newbie, and you did fine." He smiled back, surprised at her deference. She had shown considerable skill and could have hammered him like Carly, but she did not. He genuinely liked her. He grinned and said, "You didn't do too bad yourself."
Chapter 61. I was slipping through the trees, closing in on Knuckles, when I got the call from Jennifer. 2 down, 1 to go. I saw Knuckles ahead and heard Jennifer say, "Targets are hidden, but they're armed. You want us to take the weapons?" "No. Leave them on the bodies. Give the police something to hang on them when they're found. They're no threat to us now." "Roger all. You guys need help?" "Nope. Get Carly out of here. Blood's bringing an exfil vehicle. All I need is Knuckles. I want you to prep for reception. We can store him in the van. But I need some life support equipment and a guard roster." Jennifer said, "Roger all, I can do that. One more thing, get Kurt on the line. Let him know what happened, and that we have a detainee." She said, "Through no fault of our own?" "Well, of course. I can't help it if the man guys hunting is now hunting us. Works out." She said, "I can do that. See you at the Flame Fest." Meaning the after-action review when we were done. She was not so subtly telling me she was going to have an issue with this operation. I smiled and said, "See you there." I caught up with Knuckles on a park bench, tossing bread to the pigeons and looking like he was just killing time. I slid next to him, saying, "Where are they?" "Straight through the trees to the left by that fake pond. They're talking on the phone." I laughed. "Or more likely not talking on the phone. All targets down and they're trying to figure out what to do. They can't get anyone on their team. As far as we know, they might have 100 people in here. No way. If they did, they'd have reacted differently. There might be one more team to the north, but they're no threat." I couldn't see who he was talking about because of the trees. I said, "I need eyes on." He said, "Switch with me. You can see them, they aren't moving." I did and focused on the Arab. He was about 5'7", but looked solid, like he lifted weights. Not something I was used to seeing in a terrorist target. The other man was a nondescript pipe swinger, with a ubiquitous leather jacket and a thick beard. I watched the Arab's actions for a minute, then said, "That guy works out." Knuckles knew exactly what I meant by the statement. Anyone who worked out consistently had a discipline, a control over his destiny that most did not. It may be just to pick up chicks, but an Arab doing so was an indicator, not necessarily in a bad way, but an indicator nonetheless. Okay, given that he was in a park with a known Greek organized crime man hunting a CIA agent, it was in a bad way. I watched a little bit longer, then said, "And he's hyper alert. He's looking for the bad man." I focused on his face, but couldn't make a connection to the pictures we had. He was simply too far away. I said, "You sure he's one of the guys from the target package?" Knuckles laughed and said, "Hell no. Those pictures weren't the best and that guy has no beard. But there was something about his eyes. Remember the intel pictures on the armband? 3 guys looking like the usual inbred terrorist fuck and that one guy looking like a mugshot. Where he wanted to kill the photographer?" I nodded, "Yep. That's this guy. I don't know when that picture was taken, but this guy has the same look, same eyes. Like he's pissed off at the world." I considered his information, then gave him my ultimatum. "Okay, they're the same looking guy. I think it's him. But I'm not betting my career on it. What do you think? Is this good enough for Omega for you?" Knuckles looked at me. "You want permission from me?" I said, "Yeah, I guess I do. Carly's out clean, mission accomplished. But Guy is still out there, and that Arab is involved. Do you think taking him down is worth it?" He sat for a spell, then said, "Yeah, Guy's worth it. And that fuck is the key." I heard the words and felt a swell of vindication. Knuckles deflated it fairly rapidly. He stood and said, "Besides, this won't be the first time I've done something stupid, but it's always with you for some reason." I rose up and said, okay, no reason to rub it in. I'll take the Arab, you take the beard guy. Rip his ass quickly, because I'll be jamming a barrel into the Arab's ribs. I need him to see he has no alternative. I don't want him to even think about a fight." He said, "No issues. You want to do it here, or let them move?" "Hang on a sec." I got on the radio and said, Blood, what's your status?" "Got the vehicle and I'm inbound. I can circle the block a few times, but there's no parking. President's Palace takes priority. I do a couple of loops, and I'm going to draw some stairs." Knuckles said, "Guess that answers the question. Yeah, it does. They're parallel to the southern exit right now and nobody's around. I say we take them. Someone shows up and we're done. I started walking to them, saying, Yeah, story of my life. Just take that guy down quickly. Then we're moving straight west, both of us controlling the Arab. I keyed the radio and said, Blood, we're moving to interdict status. One block over, standing by on your call, be advised there's an armed security guard on the building adjacent to the exit. Doing what? Doing nothing but standing. No idea why, but he's got an MP5. Looks old and worn, like it's passed from man to man. But the building is something worth the investment. Knuckles heard the words and glanced at me. I raised my brow and he just shrugged, telling me to go ahead. I picked up the pace, closing on our targets. The Arab was standing stiffly, looking annoyed. The Greek was dialing his phone. I knew he would get nothing. They were both on the edge of a man-made turtle pond, the concrete cracked and worn. To their left was a stand of shrubs about 10 feet away, where we'd stashed the body of the guy on the phone. We hit the apex of the lake, the path leading us right at them, and I looked at Knuckles an unspoken command. Showtime. I unholstered my pistol, a compact Glock 27, chambered in a 40-caliber round. Knuckles quickened his pace, getting one step ahead of me. We got within 5 feet of our targets before they noticed we were there. They ignored us, intent on their phone conversation, or lack thereof. Knuckles came abreast of the Greek and whirled, roping his arm over his head and kicking his knee at the same time, the man's neck taking his full weight in the bend of Knuckles' arm. Knuckles tucked his shoulder into the man's head, forcing it down, then used his other hand to lever the arm, scissoring it into the carotid arteries and cinching tight. The Arab saw the action and gasped, starting to react. I threw my arm over his head and pulled him close to me, jamming my Glock into his kidney. I spoke into his ear, saying, Easy, easy, don't move. He froze for an instant, then surprised the hell out of me. In one fluid move, he stepped to the right, hooking his leg behind mine and bending down. With his right hand, he swept the weapon out, pushing the barrel away from his body, at the same time jerking upward toward his leg, breaking my balance. He coiled, then threw himself backwards. He landed on top of me and swiftly rotated around, attacking my weapon arm with both hands, clamping the hand and trapping my elbow. His head buried into my chest to protect it, he began working the hold, now inches away from an arm bar that would shatter my shoulder. He locked the hold together in a classic paintbrush and began to sweep the ground with my wrist, the entire action happening so fast I was stunned. I lost the weapon. He was strong, and Jesus, he could fight. I felt my shoulder begin to give and instinct kicked in. I rolled my body towards the sweep, breaking the tension on my shoulder and punching him in the back of the head with two jabs. He continued to work the hold, and I knew I needed to get him to focus somewhere else. Punching wasn't working. I reached across his head with my left hand and clamped my hand onto his forehead, searching for his eyes with my fingers. I pulled his head backwards, gouging his eyes as hard as I could from my weak position. He screamed and jerked upright, giving me immediate relief on my arm. I pulled my arm free and clamped my legs around his waist, then reached across his body, grabbing his shirt collar with both hands, my arms forming an X. I yanked out and saw his eyes bulge. He tried to pry my arms open, yanking and grunting to no avail. I pulled harder. He hit me in the face, but I didn't quit. Huffing like a bull, he rose with brute strength, holding me in the air, my legs around his waist and my arms cinching his shirt into his neck. He slammed me back into the ground, my body taking the full force of both our weights. One of my hands broke free, and it was enough of a respite for him to continue. He collapsed on top of me, and we began swimming our limbs, both fighting for position, arms and legs moving in and out in a game of action and counteraction. Neither one of us gaining dominance. The only noise, the slapping of skin and the hissing of our breath. In desperation, he went back to attempting to pound my face, forcing me to tuck my chin and block with my arms. I rotated one leg high, slamming it against his neck, trying for a triangle choke with my thighs. He swam an arm under, preventing it, and I immediately reversed and torqued with my body, flinging him over with my leg against his head. He landed on his back and mule kicked with the strength of both thighs, throwing me off. He leapt up, doing a Bruce Lee kung fu flip-up like he was being filmed. He saw Knuckles sprinting towards him and took off, running flat out into the park. I rose, breathing heavily, the whole fight lasting no more than a few seconds. Very few things were as exhausting as grappling with someone who knows what they're doing, and the entire event was something of a shock. I said, "What the fuck took you so long?" He said, "Me? My guy is down. What the hell were you doing?" I wiped the sweat from my face, dusted off my clothes, and picked up my useless Glock. That guy can fight. If there's a terrorist camp out there teaching his skills, America's in trouble.
Chapter 62. Guy popped another Red Bull and slugged half of the can, absently scratching the bandage over the puncture wounds in his calf. He needed the caffeine, given that he was definitely running on a lack of sleep. But today was the end game. The trap was set. All he had to do was get back inside Hyder's car to arm the device. A perfect final piece of justice, mimicking the way his brother had died. Only Guy's attack would be surgical. No massive explosion. No dead civilians. No collateral damage whatsoever. He'd been very, very busy the last 30 hours. He'd left Nikos and the rest of the dead where they lay, fleeing down the fire escape to the street below, pausing just long enough to use his socks as an improvised bandage on his leg. Then blending into the crowds on the main avenue fronting the sex club. He'd left his car where he'd parked it, preferring to walk the 6 or so blocks to the Athenaeum Intercontinental Hotel, wanting to start the mission immediately. He'd entered, completely calm, ignoring the pain in his leg and the surreptitious glances at the blood on his jeans. He knew if he acted relaxed and normal, they'd logically connect the color to paint or some other stain. Nobody who was wounded would be acting as he was. The attack of Nikos was already behind him, giving him no other thought than he'd purchased breathing room to accomplish his mission. It had been bought with blood, but he was fairly sure he'd cauterized any threat from local forces. His only concern was that it would alter his target's planned actions. They might even flee back to Cotter. He didn't think so because he was convinced they had a mission to accomplish, some greater obligation that would force them to remain. But that wasn't a given, which required rapid action. The hotel lobby was large, stretching out in all directions, marble walls and pillars dominating the place. He'd looked for a spot to set up, out of sight of the exit, and found 2 escalators to the right of the reception desk. They went down an additional 2 floors below street level to a section of meeting rooms and scattered tables for breaks from conference panels. The top was open to the lobby, like an indoor mall, but he doubted his target would look down, and he didn't need to look up. He'd used Nasser's phone history to program the gremlin with the number Nasser had been talking to when he was captured, clearly another target, and had set an alarm to notify him when it was in proximity. He'd sat for a little under an hour, reading a stray English newspaper and impatiently staring at the tablet screen of the gremlin. He was running through other options for tracking the target, considering an attempt to locate his room, when the gremlin had triggered, surprising him. The phone was in the lobby, and the gremlin had automatically attacked it, attempting to insert the same malware Guy had used to trap Nasser. The signal strength from the gremlin told him it was too weak for a rapid insert. At this pace, it would take 15 minutes, and he was sure he didn't have that time. He needed to close the gap. It was a risk, but he wanted eyes on to determine a profile of his target anyway. He ignored the escalators as they spilled out right into the heart of the lobby, and instead moved to the elevators in the rear. He exited behind the reception desk, looking at his screen. The handset was still captured, and the signal strength was growing. He moved adjacent to the concierge's desk and saw three men outside the glass doors of the entrance talking to a bellman. Two were from his brother's target package. One was the man he'd followed in Crete. All of them together, waiting on a vehicle. Exactly what Guy wanted to see. A valet brought a car around, and Guy trained on the model, needing crucial information. It was a late model Audi A7, a very expensive automobile, with very unique security components. But no automobile was completely safe if one knew the weaknesses. In the old days, it would be a physical, metal key or a Slim Jim and a hot wire. In modern times, it was all about the digits. He watched the man enter, noting the positions, as his primary target's location would be critical. They settled in and drove away. He'd learned three things he needed to know. One, the make and model of the car. Two, that they used the valet, so the key would be stored with every other valet key. And three, his primary target took the passenger's seat, with the man from Crete driving and the other man from the target package taking a seat in the back. He'd retrieved his car, retreated to his hotel, and got online. In the not-so-distant past, say less than a week ago, he would have had task force assets to accomplish what he wanted. But that time was gone. Luckily, the task force didn't do research and development in a vacuum. They relied on operators to determine the direction and focus, relied on the men who would use the equipment on the ground to test and refine. All task force operators were trained in obtaining vehicles in the absence of a key for an extremis use, but they realized that they were learning rudimentary skills suitable for a B-movie made in the 80s, with the car industry moving leaps and bounds every year, just like everything else in the internet age. In between deployments, Guy had been detailed to an automobile cell, created to teach the means for stealing a car with the latest electronics and security. They'd developed workarounds for just about every make and model, a tiring slog, given the number, but in the process, Guy had learned one thing. The crooks were already ahead of them. And that's where he turned now. People in the past who had provided unwitting assistance to a unit they didn't even know existed. He sent an email to an account in Beirut, Lebanon, that manufactured the two devices he needed, asking for a dealer in Athens, Greece. The man's website sold the products to help locksmiths recover vehicles. But given the features touted, the legality was thinly veiled. Things like clone a key within 40 seconds, immediately render safe the alarm system, and container can be shaped in a multitude of forms. A bunch of features that would have no bearing if the owner were standing nearby. He closed the computer, letting the message do its work, then reserved a room at the Athenaeum with his final pay-as-you-go card. That done, he went to an electronics store for the components he'd need for his trap. Nothing special, and all commercial, off the shelf. By the time he'd returned, he had his answer for a contact in Athens. The man in Beirut, not even bothering to ascertain why he wanted to know or whether he was law enforcement. 2 hours later, he had the equipment he needed to access the car. In truth, during the transaction, he'd had more fear he was dealing with someone who knew about his connection to Nikos than the man did about his being out to set him up. Clearly, nobody in Greece cared about car theft. He was running on fumes, but he was set. He needed only two more pieces of information: where they stored the keys for valet, and where they parked the car. He'd returned to his hotel, eating a soggy gyro for a meal, and waiting until nightfall, catching the only 3 hours of sleep he'd get for the foreseeable future. After midnight, he'd returned to the Athenaeum. He sat across the street and waited, watching the movements of the valet drivers taking the vehicles from the rich after a night on the town. He located a closet just inside the front door where they placed the keys, the same one that was used to temporarily store luggage from guests. Perfect. Chapter 63. After identifying the location of the key storage, Guy entered the garage, searching for the valet spaces. There were just two floors, and the valet spaces were fairly easy to find. In minutes, he located the Audi in a corner, away from the lights, one of only seven cars parked in the valet spaces. Even better. He checked for cameras and found two, one near the entrance to the garage and one near the elevators. None focused on the valet parking. He returned to his car and retrieved his equipment, then went to the front desk, dragging a carry-on roller and holding a briefcase. He checked in, got his keys, then said he was late to meet a friend at a bar, delayed plane and all that, and had no time to go to his room. Would they hold his luggage until he returned? Of course they would. He watched to ensure that the bag went into the same closet he'd seen before, then exited the hotel, taking the briefcase. He walked around the block, then penetrated the garage, now moving swiftly. He went straight to the Audi, going around to the front, against the wall, and opened the briefcase, pulling out a black box with an antenna and a digital readout. He turned it on and saw a read of three different codes from three different cars. Modern-day vehicles have an enormous amount of encryption technology embedded into the key fobs they use. Rolling codes, timeouts, shifting encryption. All were designed to defeat the latest cat-and-mouse game of stealing the transmitted unlock signal, and for the most part, did prevent him from doing that very thing. But his target also used an RFID transmitter, whereby if the physical fob itself was close to the car, a person could unlock or lock the vehicle simply by touch, without sending a code. It was considered the perfect security, because the signal was so low that the fob had to be present for the door to unlock, within a meter or two. And if the fob was present, it must either be stolen or be from the owner. If it were stolen, then no amount of encryption would matter. After all, if someone stole the keys to a 1970 Volkswagen, the same thing would occur. So it wasn't something to worry about, except ingenious thieves had found a workaround. His contact in Beirut had developed an amplifier that would take the weak signal of the key fob and transmit it over 400 meters to a mated receiver, which would in turn transmit the same signal to the car, in effect tricking the car into thinking the fob was present, the computer inside not realizing the fob had turned into the size of a briefcase. It wasn't exactly easy, as the amplifier had to be within 2 meters of the key fob, and had to be there for the length of time it took to enter the vehicle. Not a technique that would work with someone moving around with the key fob in his or her pocket, but something that was easy for a key fob locked in a valet closet. He clicked the first signal, then touched the handle of the driver's door. The car remained locked. He clicked the second and touched. The headlights flashed and the doors unlocked. He smiled. Money well spent. He pulled the handle and slid into the footwell. He withdrew a blank Audi key fob and a small device with a circle of plastic on one end and a data connection on the other. He rotated on his back and pulled open the ODB2 port that was used for diagnostics of the vehicle's engine via the car's central computer, the one that controlled everything about the vehicle, including its security codes. The key fob security was designed to prevent the codes from being stolen out of the air while in use, not from inside the vehicle itself. Access to the car laid bare the entire system. After all, even owners needed a way to program a new fob, and that had to happen in conjunction with the vehicle itself. The ODB port was the gateway for doing so, and was mandated to work with a standardized software program to prevent the manufacturers from building in a proprietary system that would force the owner to only use their service centers for diagnostics. It was a bit of legalized egalitarianism that worked in the car thief's favor. He plugged in the data connection, waited for the LED light to flash, then placed the key fob blank into the plastic circle. He just sat over a minute, then saw the LED strobe for 5 seconds before shutting off. He unplugged from the port, then held up the fob. Moment of truth. He pressed the button, and the door locks snapped shut. Now under the command of his new fob. He had no idea if the car would start, and no intention of trying. The man Beirut claimed it would, but also stated that there were variables and models he couldn't control when it came to actually driving the car. Just getting in was assured, but running the vehicle was out of his hands. A disclaimer, you know, because he truly cared about helping out the owner with a new key fob. Guy didn't care. All he needed was a way to access the car on the move, without the laborious briefcase trick. He put the fob down and withdrew his final items from the briefcase. The hand grenade he'd taken from Nikos's office, a digital battery-powered capacitor, and a section of wire colored black and white. He'd already rigged the grenade for an electrical charge instead of the friction primer that was normally used, drilling out the spring that rotated the firing pin, rendering the grenade safe before continuing. From the driver's seat, he taped the digital capacitor to the body and connected the wires running out of the fuse set. He pushed a button, checking the battery on the capacitor and the connection with the fuse, making sure he had a clean circuit. A light flashed green, telling him the capacitor could store the electrical charge he'd need and the circuit was good. He went to the passenger's side and opened the door, flicking off the overhead light. He spent 30 more minutes underneath the seat, securing the grenade under the cushion and splicing the leads into the airbag release system, his chosen form of initiation. In all modern cars, there was a small pressure switch in the passenger seat that let the computer know if someone was occupying that space, which in turn told the computer to arm the airbag. This was what he leveraged. When he was done, he had a perfect pressure plate booby trap. Should someone sit down, they'd close an electrical circuit, and in so doing, initiate the grenade. He tested the components for electrical flow, saw it was good, then disconnected one of the leads, defusing the system. He wouldn't arm it until he was sure his target was in the vehicle, which was the point of the new key fob. It wasn't foolproof, as the grenade fuse would still require 4 to 5 seconds to explode, enough time to escape if someone were switched on to a threat. In addition, the seat itself would mitigate the blast, but he was sure it would kill whoever was inside the car, and he thought the mitigation was a good thing. He didn't want any collateral damage from innocents walking by the vehicle, or because someone different used the car. Which was why he was sitting on Pericleos Street, just down from the embassy of Qatar, slugging Red Bulls and waiting on his targets to exit. He'd watched the Audi appear early in the morning at the Athenaeum Hotel and was pleased to see the same package as yesterday. The driver from Crete, the primary face from the target package in the passenger seat, and the secondary one in the back seat. He'd begun to follow, just waiting for the chance to arm his trap. Sooner or later, they'd stop for lunch or something else, and he'd got the chance to turn the expensive ride into a death trap. Today was the day. Chapter 64. Hyder not only heard the displeasure through his father's chosen words, but he also recognized the disgust in his father's voice. even through the VPN connection. The enunciation leaving no doubt that the man on the other end thought he was talking to an idiot.
So you actually had your friend attempt to interdict a meeting with the CIA? And you thought this was prudent? Well, honestly, he did it on his own.
His father's answer surprised him.
At least he tried something, for his little good it did. Does he understand what the CIA is?
Father, I have a man attempting to kill me and my friends. He's already succeeded twice. Our intersection is Nikos, and he said the killer was tied to a CIA contact. It was how Nikos had met the man. Nikos was following her and agreed to help us help eliminate him, after the meeting with the CIA.
And yet you failed. For the second time.
Father, we didn't know they would have an entire team there. We just thought it was a meeting between two people. It was a way to stem the bleeding without exposure. We weren't doing anything to the CIA agent.
Hyder saw his father lean back, the screen making his actions jerky with the weak connection. Sharif rubbed his face, then said,
"You broke up a CIA meeting. A meeting you knew was CIA. Why do you now think the team was out to get you? Of course they had a team. That attack on your friend wasn't because they were hunting you. It was because you interrupted a meeting with the CIA. We didn't interrupt anything. We were going to track the man that's doing the killing after the meeting. They struck first, without us doing anything. Khalid said that they tried to capture him. Does that sound like a team providing protection? Shut up. And use your head for a change. I swear, how you survived in Afghanistan is beyond me. Khalid entered the park. Khalid attempted to interdict the meeting. How can you possibly say they were out to capture him? Do you mean they actually set up an enormously complicated trap, feeding Nikos information, knowing that he would feed it to you, and that you would be stupid enough to react?
In the cold light of day, his father's logic crushed the conspiracy theories from the discussions the night before. Maybe they were reading too much into the attack, but that didn't alter the fact that two of his friends were dead, one for sure, and another who had simply disappeared. He said,
"Father, you might be right, but I want to leave here. Yesterday may have been my fault. But there is still a team chasing us. Still someone who wants to see me dead."
Sharif shut that line of discussion down.
"No son of mine is a coward. At least your friend Khalid had the courage to attempt to capture the American, even if he failed. You will not flee from the operations simply because it has become dangerous. Do you understand?"
The words were as abrupt as a physical slap.
"Coward? Who said anything about fear?"
He said,
"No, I don't understand. Staying here waiting to get attacked is stupid. It's not helping anything. Courage and stupidity are two different things. In fact, it might be hurting the very mission you want. I should go to Oslo to prepare."
Tariq, his father's confidant, showed the hint of a smile. Hyder took it as a good sign. Sharif waved his hand as if he'd had enough of the discussion. He said,
"You can't go to Oslo until you know when the meeting is to occur. I think I learned that today. I have a meeting with Secretary Billings today, and I think the peace talks are soon." "Do you have the Shahid? Is he ready?" "Yes, he's acting as my driver, the same thing he will do in Oslo. The problem is he has no way to get into the country. He has a passport from Afghanistan, and no visa for Norway.
We paid for the documents before we knew where the peace meetings were going to occur.
Go back to Nikos. Money is no object. Pay what he wants.
Nikos has disappeared. He won't answer the phone or the email he gave us. Khalid thinks the park mission scared him and he's gone underground. Either way, he's no help.
Sharif thought for a moment, then said,
Talk to Secretary Billings. Tell him your predicament. Tell him you have a confidant well-versed in Afghanistan affairs, both from the Taliban and from the government. He's your inside man, and he's necessary if they truly want an unbiased look from Qatar. Tell him he has an Afghanistan passport and that he's going to act as your driver to deflect attention, but he needs a visa. The government of Qatar can't help, given how secret this meeting is.
Father, he's not going to provide a visa from Norway for an unknown man from Afghanistan.
Yes, he will. He likes the intrigue. He wants to be secretive, thinking he's manipulating events outside of the primary participants. He wants to do something like this. Or he'd have never asked for your help. Trust me, I have dealt with men like him many times.
Haider heard the words, and for the first time in his entire adult life, he felt pride in being his father's son, and admiration at the Machiavellian manipulation proposed. His father understood the levers to pull without ever having met Secretary Billings. And Haider, having worked with the secretary, knew what his father said rang true.
Haider said, I can ask and see what he says.
He'll say yes. He's infatuated with his own importance. He wants to report back to his president that he's in control and manipulating events for the United States. Make no mistake, he believes he needs you more than you need him. And I think it is absolute poetry that we will use him to facilitate the means of his own destruction.
Haider said,
Okay, I'll do my best. What about the car? Is it ready?
Yes, I've arranged for you to pick it up. Just tell me when.
Haider nodded and said,
We'd better go. I have a bit of a drive. I hope you're right about the American Secretary of State.
I am. But the results will depend on you. If you fail and cannot get your Shahid to travel with you, you can be the one who drives the vehicle.
Haider laughed, but the look on his father's face left doubt as to whether he was making a joke. Chapter 65. Guy found himself nodding off, his head actually hitting the driver's side window. He snapped awake, looking toward the small guard shack. He saw a blip of activity from the bored Greek national inside. The man was staring at the ramp leading under the building. Something was happening. The guard shack alone belying that this was a simple office building. It would seem strange to an American who is used to seeing the power projection of the United States overseas. With embassies full of flag-waving and imposing blocks of granite. But the embassy of Qatar was located on the third floor of an office complex built over a bike shop and auto parts store, out on a lonely stretch of road in the northern part of Athens. One wouldn't even know the building had anything to do with Qatar, except for a lone flag flying on the roof and a restricted entryway guarded by the Greeks. Like a lot of countries in the world, Qatar had no need to advertise their presence. In fact, doing so would only open them up to security risks they had every reason to avoid. And so they had an embassy inside an office building, with minimal indication it even existed. It worked fine for them. Unlike the United States, there wasn't exactly a line of people fighting for a visa from Qatar. Guy focused on the guard's actions. When he saw him press a button and the drop bar to the concrete ramp rose, he leaned forward, hand on the ignition. As he saw an Audi crest the steep drive from the underground garage, he turned the keys. When he saw the man in the passenger seat, he pulled out, tagging two cars behind. He dragged anchor as they moved through traffic, going steadily north. He thought the car would head back into the city, but it didn't, and he regretted sitting and waiting, wasting his chance. Infiltrating the underground garage beneath the building would have been a significant challenge, but he might have missed his opportunity. While they didn't advertise their presence, Carter had invested heavily in security. He could probably penetrate, but he was positive he'd be on camera after the killings. Something for the police to tear apart. So he'd opted to wait. The Audi drove steadily, now heading west. 30 minutes later, Guy wondered where it was going. He thought it was to one of the suburbs surrounding the city, perhaps to continue their criminal activity. Something he would really love to interdict. But the car entered 75, a major highway that threaded out of the city to the hinterlands of the rest of Greece. Clearly, they had a purpose, and it wasn't in Athens. Guy stayed behind them, the trip passing an hour and the car continuing on the highway. His mind drifted, thinking of the end game, thinking of the destruction. And the follow-on, or the lack thereof. He was going to complete his mission, kill his man, and got nothing from it, nothing but revenge. He had the safe deposit key, but couldn't access it by himself. They drove on, steadily going northwest, the road stretching out, passing tourist buses, and making him wonder where they were headed. His mind toyed with the mission over and over, trying to feel the vindication he had before. He thought about Pike Logan, about the meeting on the ferry. He had so wanted them to join him, so wanted absolution. Pike, of all people, understood what he was doing. Pike had lost family and had exacted his revenge. Nobody talked about it out loud, but everyone knew he'd killed a man in interrogation isolation. A devil who was a terrorist and deserved it, but also a man who had murdered Pike's family. Pike was a stone-cold killer, an operator whom some people in the task force feared but everyone respected, and Guy believed he was the same. He knew it. He just wanted someone else to tell him it was so. Pike's face sprang into his memory from when he'd walked away on the ferry. A mixture of fear and pity. He did not want to be remembered that way. He didn't deserve to be remembered that way. 2 hours into the trip, blindly following the Audi in front, winding into the mountains of northern Greece, he made his decision. He'd kill the fucks who'd murdered his brother, then turn himself in. He still had the key to the safe deposit box, and he was sure it would vindicate him. Once the task force found the information it held, they'd back off. He was in the right, just like Pike. He came out of his thoughts when the Audi pulled to the side of the road, into one of the many parking slots that had appeared while he was lost in thought. He passed by it, ignoring the passengers and staring straight ahead, finding the next available spot on the small two-lane road. He pulled in, then assessed where he was. A tourist spot. Of that he was sure because of the number of cars. He glanced around and found a sign just outside of the parking area, proclaiming the hours of a museum. Delphi. The target had parked downhill from the archaeological site of the famous Delphi ruins. But why? The answer came as soon as he thought of the question. The target was conducting a personal meet and using the expansive grounds as cover, which meant they'd all leave the car. He picked up his cloned key fob, rubbing it with his thumb like a talisman. Perfect. This ends Disc 8.